Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The Slate Political Gabfest is brought to you by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for Stamps.com and get a four-week trial and a $110 bonus offer when you use the promo code GABFEST. And by Bonobos. Bonobos takes the pain and hassle out of finding stylish clothes that fit. For a limited time, all new customers can get 20% off their first order at bonobos.com/gabfest. That's bonobos.com/gabfest. Discover the difference that an expertly crafted, better-fitting wardrobe can make. And by HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new, delicious recipes, complete with step-by-step instructions. They're designed to take around 30 minutes. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter GABFEST when you subscribe. You'll get $35 off your first week of deliveries.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for January 15th, 2016, the There Once Was a Union Made, But Not Anymore edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. John Dickerson of Face the Nation is in Vermont. I'm sure he got that Woody Guthrie reference, didn't you, John?
No, I missed it.
The title.
What was the Woody
Guthrie? There Once Was a Union Made?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I was...
You're already boring him.
I'm sorry. I was off in the mountains in my brain. Sorry.
Anyway, there's Dickerson in Vermont. But here in Washington with me in our studio, it's Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine. Hello, Emily.
Hello, David.
We're all back together. I feel like it's been an age since we've done a show together. It has been weeks, months.
Well, it has been the whole turning of the new year. So that's true.
It's been the turn of the new year. But I don't think we haven't been together for 4 weeks. Practically.
Crazy.
On this week's GABFEST, Bernie Sanders chases Hillary Clinton in Iowa. Can he catch her? Then the Supreme Court sharpens its knife to gut and fillet public employee unions. Then Sean Penn's El Chapo interview. Was it morally wrong for him to do that interview? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, we will quell over the stumbles of a rich guy. It's always nice to talk about the stumbles of a rich guy. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GABFESTPlus. The Republican race is catching most of the headlines right now, but there is a quiet storm brewing on the Democratic side. As Bernie Sanders has essentially caught Hillary Clinton in Iowa polls and leads in New Hampshire polls, Clinton, who's been campaigning fairly modestly, I would say, has also been forced to slap aside claims that she might be indicted over her emails or that she's bad for women because her husband is a sexual predator. John, why is Hillary Clinton slipping or is Bernie Sanders rising or both?
I think Bernie Sanders is rising. Hillary Clinton is bedeviled by all the stuff she has been, which is a lack of deep enthusiasm among base Democratic voters for her and questions about her trustworthiness. But Bernie Sanders is, you know, continuing to kind of build on the momentum and the love that he's shown. Bill Clinton used to say, you know, Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. People are in love with Bernie Sanders. And as far as the polls show, they're like, it's working for him. We'll see. We still have, there's still quite a lot of time. But it's definitely in Iowa in particular, the just the ghosts of 2008 when Hillary Clinton was ahead and then Obama doubled the number of people who traditionally turn out for the caucus, which is amazing. In 2004, 120 some odd thousand turned out, 240 the next time. Like that idea of just enthusiasm breaking the scales, you know, is just something that is hovering over the Clinton people. And you know that even without talking to them because of the uptick in the attacks on everything from guns to healthcare with Bernie Sanders. And we can talk about the healthcare one, but there's something about the nature of the healthcare attack that's really amazing in that it's kind of it has a kind of break glass in case of emergency feel.
Well, I can't remember. Do Democrats and Republicans caucus on the same night?
Yeah,
they do, but not in the same way. The Democrats have this more complicated system where they, if somebody doesn't, I believe this is true. It's been since 2008, but if you don't get 15% of the vote in the caucus, then your votes can be distributed.
Right.
Now that is not really in play this time around, probably because Martin O'Malley's, you know, votes are not likely to be so numerous that they would then get redistributed. There was a huge, remember, with Edwards and. They do go on the same night.
Emily, do you think that part of the Sanders rise has to do with the fact that on the Republican side, you have this incredibly fun, vigorous, dynamic race, and there's a little bit of race envy, excitement envy? Yeah, and the Democrats want to grab some of that joy and some of that
I think
excitement.
That makes sense. I also think, though, that when you offer core Democratic primary voters a more liberal vision, someone who is shaking his fist at Wall Street and talking about single-payer healthcare system and offering this tantalizing possibility of an actual left agenda, of course those voters are going to be more excited about it. And it's again, it's in sync with the Republican voters. You have this moment it's a flirtatious moment of wanting to go for this person who is holding out the possibility of what you would actually like to see, even though there's really zero chance you could enact it.
Well,
in
this is one of the questions. Well, there's zero chance you could enact it in government, but there's the other question, which is maybe Ross Douthat that has a piece about this today, that there is this sense that Sanders is slightly surprised that he's in play, and he wasn't intending to run in a way that he actually thought he was going to win. So does he find himself in the position of the dog that has caught the postal van?
I think an interesting question that someone should ask him along those lines is, you know, Donald Trump says if he doesn't win, the whole thing will have been useless. I don't think the same is true with Bernie Sanders. I think that he feels like he already has changed the conversation. Hillary Clinton's focus on Wall Street and income inequality has, you know, been much more robust as a result of his challenge. And so he has achievements that he can feel confident with. And so the reason I link that to your question is if this was a message campaign in the beginning, then, you know, the message has gotten across. But he is doing things in response to Hillary Clinton that suggests, you know, he really is in it now. But I think there is a little bit of a dog that caught the fire truck feeling. And,
postal trucks. I don't think they catch fire trucks. But anyway, go ahead.
I thought it was a fire truck. Anyway, I mean, it's really going to be – it'll be fascinating to watch their next debate just to see – because remember, there was a long time when there was a sort of a detente between the two of them. They were running – you know, this was a nice kind of – quiet campaign. Now it's starting to really look like a kind of a truly ugly primary race.
So, Emily, what are the areas where they're getting ugly? Guns is one, right?
Right. And then criticism of Bill Clinton, which is building. We're having, I mean, I feel like we're going to have an endless number of waves of this form of criticism, assuming that Hillary Clinton is the nominee or just leading up to the primaries, this, you know, excavating of all of his sexual misdoings and whether she was enabling him or defending him in a way that also taints her. I feel like a lot of it is pretty unfair to her. As far as we know, she didn't know about a lot of what he was doing at the time. I also feel like their marriage should be allowed to have some semblance of we don't get it and it's their own deal and things you do in the course of your marriage to save it or to defend your spouse are like on you. But I mean, we're going to have more of that. And, you know, Sandra started playing into that.
But barely. I mean, unless I'm
only in response to a question, right?
Yeah, it was in response. And he said, he said what he did was despicable, I think. Was that the word
yes.
he used? But
mm-hmm.
then he said, basically, it's not in bounds, right? He
yes.
And also just on the larger question, I mean, clearly Donald Trump is going to be talking about this, but I think there's a split in terms of the accusations that are being made. One is the sort of the whole basket of stuff, just the, you know, and that's what Donald Trump is doing. The other is the sort of Ruth Marcus argument, which is that there is an actual, like, workplace violation here that took place between somebody who was in a position of power and a subordinate, and that's a distinct thing that is in bounds, separate and apart from what you were talking about, which is, like, the complexities of a marriage and all of that, which some people would say is out of bounds.
I mean, poof. If the fucking Clinton-Lewinsky affair wasn't litigated enough and if the country didn't damage itself enough over that, it is absolutely ludicrous that we have to relitigate that thing now. It's ludicrous. It's insane.
Right. And any allowing of it into the conversation, even though, of course, it's going to happen, but it makes it feel more acceptable and mainstream for Sanders to give it some kind of platform. And even if what he's doing, you know, when you take it apart, makes total sense and is defensible, it still lets that dog into the room.
I
sort of feel like that's, I mean, if guys asked a question and his position is the sensible one, which is of course this right. behavior was wrong, like, of course it was, but it's not
right,
you know, it's not a part of the campaign. I don't see how he could do it any better, really.
Right.
I agree.
It's
yeah,
the Trump. It's
enough.
What Trump is, where Trump is going, that's the problem. John, what,
yeah,
is, what
is where Trump is,
what's the healthcare fight brewing?
Well, what strikes me as really, really, really interesting about the healthcare fight is so many different things. Okay, one, the whole campaign's making the fight, but that the Clinton campaign used Chelsea Clinton to make the attack. So that's interesting one.
What attack was it?
But didn't Chelsea just repeat things Hillary had already said?
But having Chelsea Clinton make the attack is a new player in, I mean, she's not just giving speeches and saying my mom's great.
Right.
She's arguing basically, and this is what's, I mean, it's a pretty sort of sneaky attack. Essentially what the attack is it's that Bernie Sanders is going to get rid of his health care plan, is going to cause the children's health insurance plan to go away, Medicaid to go away. All these people are going to be vulnerable as a result of his single-payer health care plan. Now, what that so dismantle Medicare, dismantle private insurance, and then it'll give, you know, Republicans so what that suggests, what's crazy about that as an attack is, I mean, the reason those things will go away is because Bernie Sanders is offering an alternative. So it's like saying, basically, I'm going to buy a new car, and somebody's saying, well, you're not going to be able to drive because you won't have your old car. But
right.
you'll be able to drive because you have your new car.
And I mean, it's attacking him as if he was on the right and she was positioning herself to his left, when in fact his new plan, it's the opposite.
Yeah, now you can attack single payer by saying there's no way, and the country just went through a huge paroxysm over something less than single payer, and are voters really going to sign up for going through another bloody, ugly fight over healthcare? Probably not, and a variety of other things. But to say that, like, it's going to get rid of all this stuff, it's an extra sneaky attack. I mean, and then also, of course, Hillary Clinton, perhaps more than, well, second, I guess, to Barack Obama now, but used to be, for a long time, the person who had outlandish claims about the health care plan she was putting forward. It was like a textbook thing so she knows what it's like to have somebody totally distort what you're putting forward. So to herself be doing that for the purposes of undermining Bernie Sanders seems to me to be an extra layer of richness here.
Do you guys think, just going back to the Obama analogy, which one of you made early on, maybe it was you, John, Bernie Sanders is a 70-something-year-old white guy.
Jewish, don't forget.
White Jewish guy. He's so not Barack Obama. When does the kind of enthusiasm, when does reality set in? Reality never needed to set in for Obama because he genuinely represented this whole demographic shift, and he himself was embodied in his skin color was somebody different. But Sanders is not that person. So the enthusiasm has to dissipate in some fashion. How does it dissipate? I mean, he's much more like Bill Bradley or something.
I think we can't forget that we're talking about Iowa and New Hampshire, two very specific, very white states in which Sanders has more appeal in the polls than he does in any other state. So once we get to South Carolina and Nevada and all the Super Tuesday states, Clinton is way up in those polls. If Sanders actually wins in Iowa and New Hampshire, which I actually would bet on it, he'll go up in those other states, but I don't think he's going to go up enough to take her down.
Do you guys think...
I think that's right. I think I would also add just one other thing is, I mean, Hillary Clinton is still... There are still a lot of Democrats who really like her. She also... what happens in some of these tough fights is that, you know, people are... still takes them a while. A lot of them decide late. I mean, it's not, you know, she has a pretty strong resume for Democrats. They like her. She's been fighting for these issues, on women and families her entire life. And she's got national security experience that Democrats trust. And I think there's an what interests me, David, to your question is when we get to the electability issue, Hillary Clinton put out an ad last Sunday in which she showed all the Republican candidates talking about foreign policy and basically said, who's the only one who can go up against them? Usually in primaries, the two big things that matter are ideology and electability. Sanders obviously has the ideology piece down because voters are looking at the economic, you know, they're looking at the inequality question first. And since he does better on that, he has the kind of ideology column better than she does. But she has electability, although maybe not. Except that what's the electability argument with Sanders? I guess it's just that he's going to create this revolution on the left that's going to swamp the Republicans. I think that it probably would incite its own revolution on the right.
Sounds like a fantasy to me.
Do you guys think, as a last question, Hillary Clinton's campaign, I mean, John, as you say, she has lots of people who support her. She has the experience. She is clearly, when Democrats look at their candidate versus the Republican, there are very few Democrats who are going to wish they had a Republican, one of the Republicans, rather than Hillary. But how does she build the excitement that she needs? So she has Lena Dunham campaigning for her in Iowa, which felt slightly desperate as a move. But is there a way that she gets people moving?
I think the way it often happens is people need to kind of put themselves in a position where they're ready to be moved, which means they really need to start making final decisions. And sometimes they decide late, last week, you know, in the last week of the race or last 10 days. So when they're in that frame of mind, she needs to have a moment, a rallying moment, a moment that shows like that she's out there fighting for a specific thing that people care about, a kind of... She needs to appear in her best self in front of them when they're in that mode in the last 10 days. And
maybe it would actually be good for her if Sanders went after her at the debate and then she could push back against him.
Right. It'll be interesting in the debate because she's, you remember, in the debate she has been very aggressive with Sanders. I mean, remember in the first debate, she went after him fast, hard, and early.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to watch that. She has always, as far as my reporting has told me, always been worried about Sanders, even when she was up by 20 points, more so than a lot of the people around her. And so that's sort of interesting. Can I just say one more thing, finally, about guns, which is the other issue on which they're having a lot of debate? Hillary Clinton basically arguing that Bernie's heart isn't really in the issue as much as hers is. What's interesting about that is it's essentially the same argument he's making about Wall Street. And those are two issues, obviously, that Democrats care a lot about. And I wonder how that plays out and whether people, you know, do people really think that if either one of them is in office, that their ability to get gun control legislation through or do things to limit the, you know, number of guns in America is going to be vastly different. And then I think on Wall Street, the same question holds, which is Bernie Sanders may want to do a bunch of things that Hillary Clinton doesn't, or even if they have the same number of things they want to do, exact identical agendas, people may think he's more passionate about it. But given the political realities of where we are, all that stuff's not going to pass. So is the difference that important? I don't know the answers to these questions.
Okay, let's hear from our first sponsor this week, which is Stamps.com. One great resolution you can make for the new year is to maximize every minute and every dollar for your small business. There's an easy way to do that, which is Stamps.com. Think about how much time you've wasted going to the post office, driving there, parking, waiting in line. Stamps.com is the better way to get postage. Just use what you already have, your computer and printer, to get official U.S. postage for any letter or package. Then the mail carrier will pick it up. With Stamps.com, everything you do at the post office, you can do right from your desk and at a fraction of the cost of one of those expensive postage meters. Right now, you can sign up for Stamps.com and use our promo code GABFEST and get the special offer of a 4-week trial and a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's Stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. Supreme Court this week heard the case of Fredericks versus California Teachers Association, considering the issue of 10 California public school teachers who want to stop being forced to pay what are called agency fees to a union they do not belong to, but which represents them for collective bargaining. They're compelled to pay for the representation the union provides for over collective bargaining, tenure, or working conditions. They say that effectively this representation or these fees are forced political speech, and they don't want to do it. When the Supreme Court overturns these agency fees, which it will, clearly, it will affect the 23 mostly blue states that allow public employee unions to require this kind of contribution. Emily, what's this case about? It's not about political – it's not about unions actually doing political activism. That's a separate issue.
We'll have to talk about how you're defining political activism, because that's the question here, right? So unions do lots of things. Some of what unions do is – clearly political activism. It's backing Democratic candidates and pushing for particular laws or platforms. And in the current system that we were just describing, if you're a member of a union and you don't support that core political activity and speech, you can get a refund of the part of your union dues that goes to that activity.
Is that private and public sector unions?
No,
both?
We're talking about public sector
Only
unions.
Only public sector unions. Yeah. For a private sector union, you couldn't get a refund for that.
I am not – well, private sector unions are not affected by right. This whole agency fee thing. They're like in their own legal world. And so this line of cases is only about public sector unions. So the question in this case is whether you could also get a refund for the part of your agency or fair share fees, that's what the unions like to call them, for the part of those fees that goes to collective bargaining. And so then the question becomes, well, is collective bargaining also political speech? Collective bargaining implicates all kinds of educational issues, right? If you define politics broadly, then who's to say that a union agreement that gives, last fired to most senior teachers is in itself a political statement? Or what about taking a stance against charter schools or any number of provisions that are part of collective bargaining? And so that is the kind of First Amendment test and concern that has been set up in this case. And it's a perfect vehicle for this conservative majority on the Supreme Court to stop allowing unions to collect these agency or fair share fees, because this conservative court loves the First Amendment. And this whole idea of compelled speech is very moving, especially to Justice Kennedy, but really to all five of them. And this is the weird case in which Justice Kennedy is clearly against the unions, and it was really only Scalia who seemed like maybe he was up for grabs. But then after argument, it was clear Scalia isn't either. And then the last thing I'll say about what the case is about is the whole question of respecting precedent, respecting the old rulings of the court. Because we have here a 1977, I think, ruling called Abood, which created this compromise, this idea that for the sake of labor peace and just to allow unions to actually represent their members effectively, we weren't going to have a free rider problem where people could get all the benefits of the unions by being a teacher effectively represented by this union without actually paying these fees. And so that precedent absolutely is going to have to be overturned in order for the court to reach the result that the conservatives want to reach here and that the plaintiffs want to reach. And so there was a lot of jockeying over that at oral argument with the liberal justices saying, wait, but people have relied on this ruling. This is a world of change.
Well, but if it's a constitutional sin, it's a constitutional sin, right?
That's exactly right. You couldn't have said it better. I bet Justice Kennedy will use some language like that. Just too bad.
Emily, for federal government employee unions and public employee unions in most or about 20, I guess, 27 states do not have these kind of agency fees. So do those unions function ineffectually? Do they have huge free rider problems? What's the What's the case that this becomes a national – this becomes a catastrophe given that half the country doesn't have it anyway?
Well, right. So half the country doesn't have these agency fees or doesn't even allow collective bargaining. There are some states in which public sector, at least state employees, aren't even allowed to collectively bargain. What we know about places like that – so first of all, there's a correlation between having a strong teachers union and the kids achieving a little more in school. There's some evidence about that specifically to teachers and education. And there is also pretty strong evidence that if you don't allow the collection of these kinds of fees, the share of the group of employees represented by the union goes way down. And so that was another thing that came up at oral argument. John Roberts, was the Chief Justice, said, well, if 99% of the teachers already are represented by the union, obviously they like you anyway. Don't worry, right? That's another lovely rhetorical part of this is like, unions, why are you demanding to collect these mandatory fees? If you're doing such a good job, everyone's going to want to join you, as if recognizing the free rider problems are separate from that dynamic. And it is certainly true that in states where these fees aren't collected and in right-to-work states, you know, the big political movement, union membership has fallen really dramatically.
Yeah. It's fallen pretty dramatically in Wisconsin, right?
Yes.
And the political result of that, of course, is that if the union membership falls and the unions no longer have the money from those dues, then the unions are less powerful to help Democrats. And so you see it has a real, I mean, on the right, conservatives are very happy that that the political effect here will be the less support for Democratic candidates.
Right. I'm a little bit concerned. I mean, I'm a Democrat. My sister-in-law is a member of a public school teachers union. I am a little bit – I'm not that sympathetic to this case. I'm a little troubled by the idea that federal government – government employees, whether state or federal government, are not quite like private sector employees, that the government is a different sort of employer. And I'm troubled with the idea that public employees get all the same union benefits that you would if you were in a private sector union, and that I'm troubled by the idea that you'd be compelled effectively to join a public sector union.
So there's a
I can't articulate it very well.
Well, I'm not sure if this is your concern, but there's a historical reality here, which is, I would say, not ideal. Historically, when we think about the importance and the like righteousness of American unions, we think mostly of private sector unions. We think of big companies screwing workers. We think of the auto industry. We think of like strikes and times when people were getting treated terribly and paid poorly and they, you know, came into factories and they all of that. What we have is a really declining private sector union in this country, and in a kind of inversion where the public sector, state, and city unions have become much more important. So there are problematic things about that. The people who guard the fiscal purse for states and municipalities aren't going to be paid more or less or have their company's worth go up or down based on what they give away. And that has caused problems in a lot of states where the pension deals unions have gotten have, you know, caused huge nightmares for state budgets. And so maybe that's part of what you are talking about here. And yet, if you think about the idea that unions have been crucial to the American middle class, I mean, there's a super strong
correlation. But I think your point at the beginning is right, which is that unions to protect against the predations of capitalism and the predations of the private sector and the, you know, the willingness of owners of capital to force people to work 60-hour weeks, to force them to work in unhealthy, unsanitary conditions, that you are absolutely right that unions were integral to that fight. The public employee unions, as I understand it, and this is my 10-second history, arose kind of to prevent political corruption mostly. They don't arise to prevent abuses of workers exactly. They arise to prevent abuses of the public to prevent people from packing government with their friends and firing people for political
nepotism
reasons.
Nepotism and cronyism.
Yeah. And that seems to me a much less – that's not as live an issue. It doesn't seem to me that deserves – that is not that's not really what we're talking about here.
I think you're underselling the public sector unions because they also make sure that these government jobs are decent jobs with good health and benefits, that you can't just be fired willy-nilly if you're a teacher because there's a new principal who wants to bring in his friends. I mean, I don't think the issues of cronyism are necessarily gone, and certainly they could come back with a vengeance if we abandon public sector unions. But I think the other argument has to do with the future of the labor movement in this country, which is already under threat. And if millions of people fall away from their state employee unions in the next few years because the Supreme Court said, you know what, you don't have to pay these dues anymore. Go ahead, take your free ride. That's going to have a real effect on the labor movement, which both has the pro-Republican candidate, anti-Democratic candidate consequence John just laid out, and then just also has this big question of what do we do about the gap in inequality in this country and the fact that throughout our history, declining union membership is associated with declining middle-class income.
Well, that's a 50-year sample. I mean, there's been declining middle-class income, and
it's
there's
an
been declining
50 years.
Union membership, but it's not. You know, the world has changed enormously since the day we had a heyday of American unions, which coincided with the heyday of America's power in the world. And those things have all been declining, and there's a global labor force. And so it is absolutely the case that American labor unions have weakened and that American middle class has weakened along with it. But these things are not – they're not necessarily exactly one-to-one – one causes the other.
So what's your alternative? What is going to be the organizing force that protects American workers and the American middle class? Like, we don't have an answer to that.
Or put it differently, where do you get as a worker, where do you get the leverage at the bargaining table with your employer?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. Emotionally, I believe in what unions do and I support them and I recognize how important they've been, but it is really hard to, I don't know. It's very hard for me to get around it in specific cases to think that I don't think it's the responsibility of the Supreme Court to protect the American labor union.
But
I don't think that
really
is its job.
But is that really what we're talking about here? Because all we're talking about are states in which the state legislatures have decided to allow unions to collect these fees, which are pretty rational kind of form of fee collection, right? You represent a whole bunch of people. Those people are going to benefit from your salary and pension negotiations, so they should have to pay something for what they're going to get out of it. Whether the Supreme Court needs to step in and wave the Constitution and the First Amendment around and tell those states, like, no, you're wrong, you have to go join Wisconsin and all the other right-to-work anti-collective bargaining states, that's a different question.
Yeah, that's fair. That's a good point. That's a good point. What other union dominoes are still to tumble after this one? Because they're going to lose on this one.
Well, then you could have a whole question about card checks and private sector unions. How much do unions – what kinds of hurdles do unions have to jump through in order to represent employees? What other barriers could we create to make it even harder for them to convince a factory or a company to become a union shop?
What do you guys think – and maybe this gets to where – question you were asking of me a minute ago. What do you guys think that the American workers can do to assert their rights against capital now? I mean, it is really hard to come up with actual practical things that workers can do that gives them power, negotiating power, power to get higher wages, power to push down their CEO's wages, which is that is like an outrage that's happened in this country. What can we do?
Well, what can workers do, or what can the
body politic?
The body, yeah.
Well, workers.
Those are two different questions.
What can workers do?
Well, the worker's best tool at the moment is go get a job somewhere else. Get trained, go and, you know, become more skilled and go somewhere else. That's not a, and that would be helped if the labor market were a little tighter. I mean, it's getting tighter, but it's not tight enough yet so that it's putting enough pressure on wages or the kind of pressure on wages that would actually help people.
It would also be a better solution if we had a really good K-12 and community college system that really educated everybody the way that...
Well, that's right, but a worker can't help that.
Well, I know, but that's another factor in all of this lack of equity, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want government solutions, then you have, there's the education portion of it. There's the make it easier for people to move from job to job so that they can exercise their, right to get leverage at the bargaining table by threatening to leave. And that's one of the claims that the president makes for the Affordable Care Act, which is that because you can now, because your insurance is no longer tied to your employer the way it used to be, you can leave and move jobs, and that gives you more mobility. Other people would argue for things like, you know, some of the protections for family leave and sick leave and even publishing of schedules on a reasonable basis so that people can know when they go into a new job that they're not going to be losing on all those other things, that there's a uniform set of protections for workers, which allows more moving around between jobs. That would be the kind of progressive response to all of that. And the conservative response would be just create a great economy in which there are shortages and people, you know, and if you're successful and work hard, you'll have jobs because you'll be wanted by lots of employers.
All right. Let's move on. Actually, before we move on, I was sinking into a reverie. Emily, is there some Obamacare case that's in front of that we're waiting for a decision from the Supreme Court? Or
Obamacare?
Is there one of those weird, like, legal...
There is some lingering Obamacare suit out there, but it's not before the Supreme Court. The thing we're waiting for is whether the Supreme Court is going to take the Obama administration's appeal of the ruling by the Fifth Circuit about Texas's immigration.
One of those weird Obamacare cases with, you know, some linguistic interpretation.
The Supreme Court. No. We're talking about the Dream, the executive order that essentially made parts of the Dream Act law, and whether the Obama administration actually gets to give immigration relief to all those folks.
All right. I'm coming back from my reverie to talk about our second sponsor this week, which is Bonobos.
Did I send you into a reverie, David?
Did you send me into a reverie? You guys were talking, and one of you was talking about, there was a word, the word decision came up, and somehow decision just sent me thinking, like, is there some other decision we're waiting for? Wasn't there an Obamacare case we talked about that was crazy, and couldn't we end up with another crazy decision, and we're waiting for it? And then Emily says no. I thought there was something. But anyway, forget it.
Jeez, you seem so insistent. I'm having doubts.
Elle, are you looking this up? No.
She will.
Okay. The GabFest is sponsored this week by Bonobos. Every guy wants to look his best, but few men want to put in the effort to maintain a stylish wardrobe. It's a hassle. It's an inconvenience to shop for clothes, to go from store to store. Bonobos takes the pain and hassle out of finding stylish clothes that fit. They have clothes for any body type and any fit preference. You can easily browse online from the comfort of your home, as I have done. You can check out top quality styles, and they have free and easy shipping and returns and personable and fast service. You can even try on clothes at one of their guide shops before you buy. Bonobos offers a full line of stylish men's clothing, all meticulously crafted for a better fit. They have shirts for the office or the weekend, suits that fit like they've been tailored just for you. They have jackets and outerwear, ties, belts, and shoes, and even golf clothes. Actually, I'm planning a golf outing, so maybe I should get some golf clothes. Their pants look stylish, feel comfortable, and you can pick your perfect fit from slim to standard to tall. For a limited time, all new customers can get 20% off their first order when you go to bonobos.com/gabfest. That's bonobos.com/gabfest. Discover the difference that an expertly crafted, better-fitting wardrobe can make. El Chapo, the notorious Mexican cartel boss who broke out of prison in July, was recaptured this week. At virtually the moment of his capture, Rolling Stone released an interview with him that had been conducted in person by Sean Penn, who, with the help of a Mexican actress and various shady functionaries, had cloak and daggered his way across Mexico to meet El Chapo. It's not clear if Penn's meeting aided in the capture. The Mexican government said it did, but they would say that, wouldn't they? But both the capture and the interview set off a firestorm of discussion about the narco policies, about Penn's journalistic ethics. Mostly, what was striking to me as a journalist, as a frustrated journalist, was that the Penn interview was just terrible.
Oh, my God.
It was terrible as an interview. Terrible. Right,
but luxuriate in the ways in which it was terrible.
Yes, well,
it begins with his maybe 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 words about his, you know, making his way to El Chapo and how he finds his way and the meal that he ends up eating with El Chapo, and talks about why he's taken with El Chapo, who he sees as a victim as much as a victimizer and a victim, as we all are, of this terrible drug war, drug policy. And then he finally gets his camera in front of El Chapo, and he asks him the dumbest freaking questions you can imagine, and gets the most boring answers. The El Chapo sounds like a bureaucrat at a very boring accounting firm.
He loves his mom, though.
He loves his mom. He was raised in poverty. He only kills in self-defense. You know, it was the only job he could get. He doesn't really think about the implications of it. It was so terrible. It was what was so infuriating about all of it. But Is there something more to say about the substance of the interview?
No, except that Lo and Liu, Slate's genius managing editor, did like line edit of notes for Sean Penn's article as if they were written by El Chapo, and they are so funny and great. Everyone has to go read them.
How would you guys have conducted that interview? First of all, would you? So the terms on which Penn got this, he had to sort of make his way across Mexico, deal with some very shady characters, and clearly like be nice to some very shady characters to get the interview. But then he had to agree to pre-approval of the – El Chapo had to approve whatever it was he was going to write. He says that El Chapo proposed to change nothing. Would you guys have agreed to those terms, first of all, to get to him and then to do the interview?
So I know this is super – not what I'm supposed to say. I would not have done this interview. I mean, A, I'm so unequipped to do this interview. I wouldn't know what questions to ask. B, I don't think it would...
You would have asked a hell of a lot better questions than Sean Penn.
Yes, so I mean, I think that would be true of like the, you know, table that we're sitting at.
You would know what questions
don't you think?
Ask.
But didn't... I mean, okay, so yes, like in some world, this is a great get. It's not that I don't see that. He hadn't talked to anyone in 20 years. He's this totally colorful figure. He's the most important drug pin of our time. Okay. But I would feel so just ill at the idea of all of the Mexican journalists, all the people who cover the drug world, all the people who actually know what they're doing. And then, like, I, because I've, like, charmed a soap opera actress, get to, like, watch. There's something just, like, gross.
You wouldn't
to
have
me.
Done the interview. Would you, John, forget the pre-approval. Would you have done the interview?
I would have done the interview. I wouldn't have done it under those ground rules.
Because of the pre-approval.
Yeah. I mean, because then what the, you know, then you're, I mean, it's interesting. So, no, I mean, I can imagine some arrangements, but not like once you write up the story, then letting him edit it.
I would have done it under
those circumstances.
I would have done it under those terms. Jack Schaefer, our former colleague at Slate, wrote, I thought, a really great piece for Politico about this. And he says... Again, he says the interview is not a very good interview. But that, yes, it's an incredible get. It's a great thing to hear. And the problem with the pre-approval, it's more that you have to – that the thing to do would have been to give El Chapo a byline. No one would have had any problem.
I love that solution.
If El Chapo's byline had been on it and it had been El Chapo, my story.
But then how could Sean Penn have written the whole first half about his, you know
– Although here's the thing, actually. Maybe we've got it wrong. And I mean, it's Sean Penn. This is not an interview. I mean, it would be different if, like, the anchor of from a major news organization or the New York Times did this or something. But this is, like, I mean, this is Rolling Stone and Sean Penn.
Right,
so
and Sean Penn essentially playing a journalist on Hollywood. I actually thought another possible interpretation for how cozy he is toward El Chapo, the whole line about how, like, oh, he doesn't seem like a big bad wolf. He said the same thing about Fidel Castro, right?
And Hugo Chavez.
And I think he's, like, playing them in a movie in his head. He's, like, right? He's not having any critical distance from El Chapo or Hugo Chavez. He's, like, imagining himself on screen playing those roles.
Yeah, and his conflation of... His belief that the problems with the war on drugs in the United States, of which there are many and are enormous, and that creates a moral free pass for El Chapo is bizarre.
And can I just say that the syntax in those paragraphs was essentially impossible to follow? They were like barely in English, really.
Oh, really?
Oh, my God. Unbelievably bad writing. I really don't understand how that piece was edited.
A friend of mine who works for a place where they sometimes have to handle celebrities – and celebrity writing got a piece of writing from a very, very famous celebrity. And it was, you can't touch, the instructions to my friend were, you can't touch this. But the celebrity had spelled a word.
It was like from MC Hammer.
It was a really important word that the celebrity had just spelled wrong throughout. And it was a homonym meeting. I'm not going to say any of this because then everyone will know what I'm talking about.
I think I knew what you're talking about.
But this friend of mine was told, you can't touch this. And this friend said, you know, there's a misspelling that I think is going to make us look bad if we publish it. And they let the misspelling be corrected. But it was very funny.
Oh, my God.
I think that Sean Penn – well, the other problem is, of course, that Rolling Stone, as we know, crawled into the unethical swamp of the UVA rape case and has not yet, in my mind, crawled out far enough that we can treat anything it does as above reproach. So anything in my view that Rolling Stone
– I just wonder if they didn't decide, hey, we're in the swamp, let's just build camp here. I mean, so if you think of it that way.
But don't you think, John, they think they've vindicated themselves and proved what swashbuckling – get the story gonzo journalists they are. There was such a self-congratulatory air to the whole thing. And, you know, when, what's Jan Weber? Is that his
Jan Wenner.
Jan Wenner. When he took his victory lap about it, I just wanted to throw
did
up.
He say, he said El Chapo did not participate in any rapes at any frat houses. It was not something El Chapo has done.
I mean, I get, you know, but people are going to be self-promoting in all kinds of different ways. I think the, and it is a coup of a sort. I mean, it's just, it's not a coup of, it's not the same kind of coup that if the New York Times did it. I mean, it's just not, it's a totally different kind of arrangement of words on a piece of paper.
My favorite anecdote about this came out, I think, in the Times today, that in fact El Chapo only cared about the actress, Kate.
Oh, yeah, he was crushing on her.
Yeah, and he said about Sean Penn, what's his name again? Who is that guy? Like, I loved that part
of it. There was a moment when El Chapo asked Sean Penn, do people know, have people heard of me in the United States? And I thought El Chapo was asking Sean Penn, have people heard of you, Sean Penn, in the United States? So I got slightly confused by that. But the
By the way, if you're Sean Penn, aren't you a little nervous?
About
right
what?
Now?
Oh, no. Well, I mean, that they'll come and take him out?
Responsible for all of these killings and whose Confederates are responsible for killings could get the mistaken impression that the arrest and the publication of the article are somehow linked. I mean, I don't know. I would be. But I mean, maybe he's brave enough. He was brave enough to go see him, so he's maybe.
But it
worried.
Also just seemed like El Chapo was glory seeking. This is all about how he wanted to have a Hollywood movie about his life that he would get to participate right. in. And so his Confederates, if that's true, then they would know that.
I don't really understand.
But my guess is his Confederates are not the kind to think like, oh, yeah, that's probably a good idea. Like, I mean, don't you think they'd be pissed?
I guess so. But who are they taking revenge for? I don't know.
I don't understand how El Chapo is a cartel boss from some house in the woods somewhere. I don't really know how he could effectively run any sort of organization.
He had all kinds of people there. And also, this totally freaked me out. When he was in prison, he saw like 400 visitors.
Well, that part I understand.
It's only since he's been in the woods. But don't you think they can just like communicate and they all have burner phones and they all run around and do his bidding?
Maybe. One of the reasons the Mexicans want to extradite him is because in the U.S. prison system, he will be incommunicado effectively, and he'll just vanish. No one will hear his name again, and he'll live with whoever it is, Manuel Noriega. Manuel Noriega is still in a supermax somewhere, right?
Oh, my God, who
Ted Kaczynski and Manuel Noriega and Shoe Bomber and the first World Trade Center bombers all hanging out in a supermax in Colorado and never speaking to the outside world. Okay. Goodbye, El Chapo. Let's hear from our third sponsor this week. The GabFest is also sponsored by HelloFresh. HelloFresh is the meal kit delivery service that makes cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes. They're great for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks who might be short on time. HelloFresh sources the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities needed so there's no food waste. And you're getting food that's healthy. HelloFresh employs a full-time registered dietitian who reviews each recipe to ensure it's nutritionally balanced. I've had a really good experience with HelloFresh. I had a great chili that I made and a really good squash risotto that I made. It was indeed, like, the vegetables were super fresh, super in great, as the name would suggest. And the instructions were very clear. The box was excellent. It was, if you've had that problem, maybe where you get sent food from somewhere and it arrives and it's not cold or it's not been protected, the HelloFresh box was superb. It was really well insulated. And it made a great meal, and it was very easy. For me, it's always more satisfying when I take the time to cook, and it's even better when I take the time to cook something that's healthy that I get to eat at the end and feed to my family.
I have a friend who totally swears by HelloFresh, says it's changed her life.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
You guys are I'm feeling like I should be ordering immediately.
You should. It's very convenient and it's easy to use. HelloFresh HelloFresh currently offers customers a classic box or a veggie box, and they'll be launching a family box too. I had a veggie box, I think. Customers can order 3, 4, or 5 different meals per week designed for either 2 people or 4 people. New recipes are created regularly. So listeners, if you visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code GABFEST, you can get $35 off your first week of deliveries. Visit HelloFresh.com and enter promo code GABFEST when you subscribe. Let's go to cocktail chatter when you're sitting on the porch drinking as you overlook your box of HelloFresh vegetables, Emily Bazelon, what will you be chattering about?
I was saddened this week by the death of David Bowie, which I realize puts me in a large group, but David Bowie was my first pop star, rock star crush. I think that maybe Ziggy Stardust is the first album that I bought. I was kind of obsessed with him in, like, I don't know, 8th, 9th, 10th grade. And I was trying to figure out why. I think it's because he was both incredibly classically handsome and super androgynous in this, like, very non-threatening way that really worked for my teenage self. So I wanted to recommend two David Bowie tributes. One is this really lovely piano tribute by Rick Wakeman that went around on Twitter, and we'll post the link to. And the other is a song by Bowie called Kooks from his album Hunky Dory. It's a very un-Bowie-like song. It's probably his, like, least cool song, which is why I really like it. And he wrote it when his son was born. So it's about being a parent and imagining having a child.
I feel like I'm the only person in my demographic who has no relationship to David Bowie. But that's okay. John Dickerson.
You didn't need a classically
handsome. John Dickerson, as I think of you, you are the thin white duke of the Gabfest, John. So.
Well, when I was a kid, my brother's girlfriend at the time used to say that I looked like David Bowie, and since I was like 12 and she was 17, there was a brief phase where I was trying to look like David Bowie, because I thought if that was
your
was
hair
working with a
17-year-old. Has kind of David Bowie moments now that I think about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, John is
and
architectural.
I had a jacket like one of the ones he had on his album cover. I think that was the
there
other.
There you
big
go.
Thing. Anyway, so my chatter is about a book I haven't read, but that I really want to read, that I saw on Brain Pickings, which GabFest listeners will know is one of my favorite websites. And it's a book by the New Yorker columnist and science writer Maria Konnikova called The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, about con men and why they are successful. And as I was reading excerpts of it, it just reminded me of politics. And so I'm going to read you two little excerpts from the book and see if it does for you as well. It's the oldest story ever told, the story of belief, of the basic, irresistible, universal human need to believe in something that gives life meaning, something that reaffirms our views of ourselves, the world, and our place in it. For our minds are built for stories. We crave them, and when there aren't ready ones available, we create them. Stories about our origins, our purpose, the reason the world is the way it is. Human beings don't like to exist in a state of uncertainty or ambiguity. When something doesn't make sense, we want to supply the missing link. When we don't understand what or why or how something happened, we want to find the explanation. A confident artist is only too happy to comply, and the well-crafted narrative is his absolute forte. So, you know, when you think about what politicians are selling to people who feel as they do in that previous paragraph I just read, it just kind of all syncs up nicely. So I'm going to go read the book, and I suggest other people do too, even though I haven't actually read the book.
2 points. One, Maria Konnikova is a regular guest on The Gist, and she, in fact, appeared at The Gist live show and was delightful. Two, there's a bit in the book, which I read about in one of the reviews, which is that apparently she wrote about some con artist who was so good that he got 7 boatloads of immigrants to immigrate to a place where there was no colony, someplace in the jungle.
Wow.
That's a con artist for you. Okay, let me go to my chatter. I'm going to do 2 chatters, actually. The first one is a very self-serving one, but you guys will be delighted by it anyway. Every year, Atlas Obscura, the media venture that I run, does something called Obscura Day in the spring, which is a one-day celebration of exploration and discovery where all around the world we put on events where people can go visit things, do things, go. This year we had a trip inside the Forbidden Zone at Chernobyl. We toured the smuggler tunnels underneath St. Paul. We had a concert at the Robotic Church in Brooklyn. And we're planning for Obscura Day 2016, which is going to be on April 16th, so mark your calendar. And we could use your help. We want to have people have even more cool things to go do. So if you work or volunteer at a place that has some wonderful collection, or you're an expert in something unusual, or you know someone who's an expert in something unusual, or you're an amateur explorer who knows some super cool place to visit in your community, we want to collaborate with you and create something for Obscura Day. For example, I did this last year where I knew about this fort in the woods in Washington, and I took people to on a tour of this incredible fort in the woods in Washington. And there was a friend of ours in Iceland who arranged a special day at the Iceland Sea Monster Museum. So it could be anything that you think will spark people's sense of curiosity and imagination and discovery. So if you have an idea, and I know that you do, please email me at david@atlasobscura.com. And I can't wait to hear from you with your great ideas. So we want to get more people out seeing the world. And then my second quick chatter is just to endorse the podcast Limetown. If you liked The Message, which was the Panoply podcast, which was sort of a real world, a radio drama about eerie happenings, eerie sci-fi kind of happenings, you will like Limetown even better. I dare to say it's even better than The Message. It's a six episode podcast. It seems to be like Serial. It's very much modeled on Serial, but it's about eerie, ghostly, real world, eerie, ghostly, fictional happenings. And it's really cool. Have you guys listened to it?
No.
It's really, really great. Fun. My kids.
Yeah, I've heard them talk about it. I haven't actually listened to it. The creators.
Our intern is El Biscar Church. Our producer today is Jason DeLeon, sitting in for Jocelyn Frank. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest, which has links to what we talked about today. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @slategabfest. Email address is gabfest@slate.com. My email address for sending me Obscura Day ideas is david@atlasobscura.com, in case you forgot. Please subscribe to the Gabfest on iTunes and leave a comment and rating while you're there. For Emily and John, I'm Plotz. It was really good to be back with you guys. We'll talk to you next week.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.